tell me what it's like to report on your own industry.
Well, I've been doing it for about 11 years now, and it's a challenge. I mean, one of the things that I think has become commonly understood, but might not have been so much a decade ago or so, is that the media is an institution much like government or major religious institutions or financial institutions or the like that have a lot of influence and deserve scrutiny themselves just as much as any other. The media is the prism through which much of the country gets to understand their communities and their world around them. And the media, I think, on the whole, does its best, although that's a painting with a pretty broad brush of a category there. But it deserves to be held accountable. It deserves to be scrutinized, and that scrutiny can come in a bunch of different ways. So when I took this on, it was after a stint as covering Congress for the Baltimore Sun, the newspaper for which I worked at the time. And this seemed to me a pretty interesting way to get at questions of the intersections of politics and policy and media and people's understanding of those vital things. So it's not simply as a watchdog, but, you know, that's part of the package there.
And when your job is to question your own employer, like you had to do earlier this year, and to report on NPR, what is that like?
Well, I mean, there are two levels to it. It's important to acknowledge that for your listeners, NPR is an important media institution. Certainly, it found itself in the middle of controversy by dint of some of its actions and some of the reactions others had to it. It seems to me that the best way to embody NPR's values is to report on it, to scrutinize it, and to present its actions fairly and fully, to contextualize it, to make sure that it's being done rigorously, and to get the story both right and, if possible, first. It's not simply to sit back and let others do the reporting for us. One of the things, regardless of what people may feel about NPR's actions in the Juan Williams case or in other circumstances, is that I think that senior management did admirably in allowing a couple of editors and me to determine the coverage that we needed to present to our listeners about this and to not interfere, even when at times some of the stories were a little painful or difficult. On a human level, it is more difficult than simply reporting on another institution with which you have less personal familiarity. Some of the people that you're reporting on are people that you know socially or professionally. They're people that you may have some ties or affinity for, and it makes it complicated, but it doesn't let you off the hook for doing your job. People know that NPR pays my paycheck, so I think it would be reasonable for them to know that I'm familiar with some of the senior officials that I may have to report on from time to time. That's just the way that the game works.
Can you explain the situation facing journalism over the last few years for people who might not have been paying attention?
I think it's fairly well established now. The news business has suffered an incredible challenge, a financial challenge, and that challenge comes in a couple different forms. It's come in the form of the economy, which has really battered particularly publishers very hard, and I'll focus for a moment on newspapers just because traditionally newspapers have provided the horsepower that has propelled journalism, even as a lot of broadcasters and these days a lot of people online have done some very good work as well. But they've been hit by the recession, they've been hit by people's changing habits in consuming news, and they've also been hit very badly by the untethering of the financing of the news business from the production of news. That is, there's no lack of appetite for news. You can see that from newspapers who have had their readership expanded through their websites. What you've seen, however, is that newspapers and, to another extent, local television stations can no longer assume that they're going to have local near monopolies on classified advertising, on job ads, on car ads, on real estate ads, all kinds of things that used to be mainstays for newspapers that would give them, you know, year-over-year increasing profit margins. You know, now people can go to Cars.com or Monster.com or all kinds of sites, and they can slice and dice the products they're looking for in a much more efficient and effective way. And newspapers were very slow to recognize that the paid sites, the Craigslist, that others were stripping away their financial model. And original reporting is very, very expensive. And therefore, the question is, what is the news going to look like? How do citizens feel confident that somebody's looking out for their interests, that somebody's watchdogging and performing accountability journalism? How do they feel confident that they know about what's happening not in their immediate environs? How do they participate in the news? How do they assure themselves that the news they're getting is not from some sort of cookie-cutter template, but actually is doing original reporting? And this has implications not simply for the financing, which can kind of make people's eyes glaze over at a certain point. After all, individual people are going to be very hard-pressed to themselves resolve the financial struggles facing the industry. But it can allow people to think for themselves, okay, what do I expect of news outlets? How am I defining where I get information from? Are there new players? Are there new sort of non-media sites that will provide me with useful information? Are there ways in which news organizations might collaborate? Are there ways in which I might vary my diet? And these are some of the more interesting and, I think, more stimulating challenges. I think this is a time not just of great struggles for the news industry, but also we're seeing a lot of great promise out there, and I think that's pretty exciting.
Can you talk about the Page One book and how you got involved as editor?
Sure. I was asked by Public Affairs Books to produce a book that would complement the documentary Page One, in which Andrew Rossi and Kate Novak, a filmmaker's husband and wife team, were able to get extensive access to the New York Times and a lot of its editorial deliberations, and particularly looking through the keyhole of the media desk, the people who do what I do, cover the news media, David Carr, a charismatic media columnist for the Times, and Brian Stelter, a young media reporter who's helped to teach a lot of his more senior colleagues how the new world of social media platforms works. And they wanted a book to complement this and explore perhaps and unpack some of the issues raised in the film in a different way. And so I took the film and I talked about this with the directors who contributed an essay to the front of the book. I took the movie as a starting point rather than as a resting place. And it seemed to me that it was useful to introduce readers who might take an interest in the movie, but also people who might come across the book on its own, to a set of voices, people who are players in the journalistic sphere, come at it from different places geographically, but also from different positions within the news industry, each offering a slightly different take on how to find value in the current media landscape. I saw one review of the book that said that the reviewer was frustrated because the essays seemed to take different tacks, to at times even contradict one another, because they found different elements to be of use. Personally, that was kind of my hope, was that we would have a varied set of voices, not all pushing in the same single unitary direction, but that there might be different slices, different approaches offered to readers so that they themselves could decide what they find value in, where they find hope, where they are likely to be more critical, what makes sense to them as they press forward.
What was the industry like for you when you first started out?
I started out 20 years ago next month, if I'm not mistaken. I had been a journalist in college at Cornell University and became editor of my student daily, which was a really exciting and revelatory experience for me. I had interned at the Charleston News and Courier during college. That was my first taste of working for a professional news outlet. And then in 1991, I joined the Herald Sun in Durham, North Carolina. I was asked to cover Duke University and higher education, which was a great beat if you think about the research triangle in North Carolina. Higher education is really the main industry driving the place, along with a few key others. And Duke was, I believe at that time, the second largest private employer in the state of North Carolina. So it was fantastic. And the basic assignment I was given was to go out there and find stories. And I had editors who I felt really supported me very much in that, Bill Hawkins and John Hamm at that time. It was exciting because to me, Reporter's Notebook was like a passport, where it gave you the ability to travel in very different worlds, from major donors to Duke and wealthy alumni to people who worked for maybe a little bit over $12,000-$13,000 a year on the university staff. I covered explosive crime charges. I covered political movements, covered social events. It was exciting and intense. You know, the newspaper then had gone through a round of layoffs, and at that time, people were up in arms in journalism that such things would happen. The price of oil was quite high at the time. It was after the first Iraq War, and yet I don't think we knew what we were in for. It was exciting to be young and to be a reporter and just hungry to find story after story without worrying so much about, I wasn't worried too much about the profession. I was worried just about finding stories, and it was exciting to be around colleagues who responded to that, who said, all right, well, let's get this story in and move on to the next.
And from there, you went on to the Baltimore Sun.
I joined the Baltimore Sun in 1994. John Carroll, who later went on to be editor-in-chief of the Los Angeles Times, was there. Bill Marimo, his deputy, who later became chief of news here at NPR and became the editor-in-chief of the Philadelphia Inquirer. He was the number two editor at the time. And they brought me up, and they taught me a lot, as did my colleagues. I mean, at the time I joined the Sun, there were 9 foreign bureaus. There were 15 people in the Washington Bureau. I can tell you now that all of those foreign bureaus are gone. There is no one left as the full-time Washington correspondent for the Baltimore Sun, to my knowledge. But it was, you know, it was a heady place. I was surrounded by, on one side, a Pulitzer winner, on another, a former Moscow correspondent. Another guy had covered the wars in Bosnia and other places. David Simon, who was, you know, the creative force behind The Wire, was there. And one of the things that Phil and John told me, and I really took it to heart over the years and reminded myself of it, is he said, you know, we're not paying you to be a stenographer. We're not paying you simply to record what people say. We're paying you to be the best informed person in the state of Maryland about the topic that you're covering that day. And, you know, it does not mean that you're merely offering he said, she said. If you think that there's proof to show that a certain, not point of view, not ideology, but a certain characterization of events is accurate and fair and full, he said, make the case. Show your readers, share them the kinds of information and building blocks that led you to that conclusion, and then present them the strongest possible counterargument. But if you find that persuasive, compelling, and unshakable, share that with your readers. Don't just simply harbor that at home. And it was, I think, a really useful model of a form of journalism that is not agenda-driven and not ideological, but is wedded to the idea of trying to piece together truth from fact. And I value that a lot.
When you switched from print to radio, was that rare for journalists to switch mediums?
I think you can point to a lot of journalists who have done that. You know, you look at Jake Tapper at ABC News. He started at, I believe he was at the Washington City Paper, and then moved on to Salon.com before doing a couple of TV ventures, the MTV, possibly CBS, and then he moved up to be a straight news reporter and does what I think is a very fine job at it. If you look at Gwen Ifill, she had been a newspaper reporter at a very senior level. If you look at my colleague Michelle Norris, she had worked in a number of prominent newspapers before joining ABC News and then later joining us as an anchor. That said, I got to tell you that inside NPR, there are still moments where colleagues of mine tease me, and sometimes not even teasingly, say, well, print people like you will approach stories in such and such a way. I find that a little comical. I've been with NPR about 7 years now, and so the idea that somehow I'm still a print person is somewhat amusing to me, but it's also a little humbling, and it's a reminder that I've got to work on my craft and work on creating stories and a narrative flow in a way that work best for broadcast. And it's also, to be honest, given me a little bit of an advantage in the sense that broadcast reporters now often write stories for the web, and web is text. And so unless you're doing a slideshow or some sort of audio presentation online, you have to be able to write stories that way too. It's a different part of the brain. You structure things differently. The architecture of the stories are a little different. But they're related but different skills, and it's a challenge. I would encourage deeply any of your listeners to not go back and listen to anything I did in my first, call it, 2 years, because it's a little hard to listen to now for me.
What do you tell students who are going into the field these days?
You got to want to do it. You have to want to do it. And if you do, if you're sustained by passion, if you're excited about it, that's fantastic. But this is not something to do because you're not sure of what to do next. I mean, I find it exciting to be paid to go and ask people questions and to knock on doors. And more often than not, people kind of open up and talk to you, particularly if they're, you know, not surrounded by a coterie of professional PR handlers. It's exciting to, you know, you see a lot of the flash and the lights, and Washington can be very exciting and heady, and the stakes seem to be very high, and we're only covering political campaigns more and more. There are a lot of other stories out there that won't get covered if you don't tell them. And I think it's important to encourage, you know, the famous phrase of John McPhee talking about the former senator and basketball player, Bill Bradley. He talked about what Bradley did away from the ball and how the way he moved as a player when he wasn't the one dribbling was really what defined him as a great college player. And I think that that, you know, is true for journalism as well, where you sort of figure out what people are doing away from the spotlight. That's often what's most telling and will influence lives the most. It's how power is exercised. And it's just interesting, I think, to unpack what is happening and figure it out, almost like stripping down a car and putting it back together again. And if you enjoy that, if you enjoy spending time with people, if you enjoy telling stories, in this day and age, if you enjoy finding new ways to tell stories online and through new technologies and techniques, I think journalism can be a really exciting place to be.